Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey. Lori Walsh is off today. Simple Justice, Suffrage in South Dakota. It's an SDPB original documentary. It airs tonight on SDPB television at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. Now, this film was about the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which ultimately gave women the right to vote. SDPB's Brian Gevick is behind this film, joins us now with more. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks a lot, Chris.
Let's talk about this show. The title itself, it sounds very, very interesting to me. You've heard over the last several months, so we've had several guests talking about this topic. Take us back to the drawing board, if you will, when this film was just a thought. What was happening back then?
Well, if you go back to really the 1860s is when the woman suffrage movement began in South Dakota. And they tried a couple of times during territorial days to get a full suffrage measure into the territorial constitution. One of the people who was really most active in that was a guy named John Pickler. He was from Fulton. And when he was addressing the 1885 legislature, he told them that, well, he's going to bring a woman suffrage amendment before him because he just sees it as simple justice that women should have the right to vote.
So there's the title, Simple Justice, kind of just handed to you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the show itself looks at the whole history of woman suffrage in South Dakota and, you know, how that relates to the national, I guess I'll say, struggle for woman suffrage. And, you know, it was actually about a 60-year battle, and pretty much anyone who was anyone in the suffrage movement nationally was in South Dakota, and they paid a lot of attention to South Dakota for all kinds of different reasons. One of the things that I found really interesting was that the 19th Amendment passed in 1919 and ratified finally in 1920, really didn't include everybody, Native Americans in particular. And, you know, for years, Native Americans could only vote in U.S. election if they essentially traded their tribal membership for U.S. citizenship. Well, after the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, they still had, you know, and most still couldn't vote. Well, in 1924, there was a federal act called the Snap Act that gave citizenship and voting rights, but there's still a lot of barriers, especially at state level. And as a matter of fact, those so-called anti-suffrage statutes were on the books until 1951. Now, I knew that there were a couple of Native American women from South Dakota who were active in the suffrage movement. I wanted to know more about them and what motivated them, so I Zoom called Kathleen Cahill. She's an author and professor of history at Penn State University, and she's done a lot of research on the subject.
There are not a very large number of Native women who are suffragists, or at least that we know of yet. But those that were on the national scene and advocating for suffrage were pretty well known and had gained a platform. People often asked them to speak, in particular, to their organizations. And I would say the three that I look at in my research that are very prominent are Gertrude Bonin, or Zitkalasa, the Yankton Lakota, a woman named Marie Botineau Baldwin, who was a citizen of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Band, and also French, so someone we might call Métis. And she talked about both of those sides of her heritage quite a lot. And then the third woman is a woman named Laura Cornelius Kellogg, who's a Wisconsin Oneida. And all three of them were very prominent on the national scene and in national Native organizations, especially the Society of American Indians. So the question of suffrage for Native people is a pretty complicated one, as I'm sure you and your listeners might know. Not all Native people wanted U.S. citizenship and the rights, including suffrage, that came along with it, because they were arguing for sovereignty for their own nations. And citizenship and suffrage in the U.S. was often used as sort of the end result of assimilation policy, was that Native people were granted citizenship and could participate in U.S. governance. So in some ways, it was seen as evidence that you had given up your tribal sovereignty. So many people and many tribal governments were hesitant to argue for it. The women that I'm looking at who were suffragists, who advocated for U.S. citizenship and suffrage, were also advocating for tribal sovereignty. They talked a lot about the treaty rights and were very concerned about land rights. And this is the moment of allotment, and land losses are just extremely high in Native communities. And for them, they were looking for any kind of tool that they could find to particularly stop that land loss, to maintain their communities, to address the really dire issues of poverty and health that their communities were facing. And so for someone like Gertrude Bonin or Zit Kalasa, she sees U.S. citizenship and the vote as a way to address some of those questions. She also sees white suffragists as possible allies. In fact, all three of them do. And they talk about, particularly in 1920, when white women primarily received the vote, that white women can be allies, right? Gertrude Bonin actually speaks to the National Women's Party in February 1921, so about 6 months after ratification of the 19th Amendment. And she says, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's close, the Indian woman celebrates with you, but then she says, but please don't forget your Indian sisters. These Native women were able to articulate an idea of almost a dual citizenship, that it didn't have to be an either or, and federal assimilation policy was really an either or. Either you were a member of a tribal community or you were a U.S. citizen, and you couldn't be both.
What was the effect of the Snyder Act? What happened in 1924 and, you know, across the board with Native people and voting?
So the Snyder Act enfranchises or grants citizenship to all those Native people who do not yet have U.S. citizenship. And that's about a third of all Native adults. But that's a really complicated number. A lot of Native veterans, when they would fill out their paperwork, there were questions about, are you a citizen or are you a ward? And a lot of them didn't know. And there's a great deal of confusion. One of the suffragists I write about, Marie Botno Baldwin, writes her master's thesis on this question of the legal relationship of Native people to the U.S. And she says it's all just completely confusing, and it changes when you cross state lines and where you are. So there's a lot of confusion about the question of U.S. citizenship for Native people. And so the Snyder Act is an attempt to just make that all uniform. It is sort of a compromise, exactly, where their land continues, maintains this trust status under the oversight of the government. They are granted U.S. citizenship with all the rights that come with it, including suffrage. Someone like Gertrude Bonin, who's been advocating citizenship and suffrage, is really excited by the Snyder Act. And she is arguing that now that Native people are enfranchised, they can form blocks in particular states. So the Native vote is a term that you see come into being around 1924. And she's talking about the Native vote. Newspapers are talking about the Native vote, and they're breaking down population by state to show where Native people might have some pretty powerful political clout. There are many non-Native people who are also thinking about this and are concerned that that's going to change the balance of power in their states. And so they come up with a whole variety of ways to then disenfranchise newly enfranchised Native people. So there's sort of those two competing currents. So for example, New Mexico and Arizona argue that even though Native people have been granted U.S. citizenship, those people who live on trust land or on reservations are still under guardianship. And according to their state constitutions, people under guardianship cannot vote. So both of those states use that to disenfranchise almost all of the Native people in their states. Montana does something slightly different. They say that you can't be a registrar of voters on reservation land, trust land. They drop everybody from the rolls and ask everyone to re-register, which is made infinitely harder for Native people because you can't have registrars from reservations, right? So you have to travel a long way to register to vote. So some of the techniques are very similar to the Jim Crow laws in the South, literacy tests and things like that. Some of the techniques really use the relationship to the federal government that Native people have, that special trust relationship, as an excuse for why they can't vote in those states.
That's the voice of Kathleen Cahill. She's author and professor of history at Penn State University, done a lot of research on women's suffrage. We're talking with SDPB's Brian Gevick. He's behind the film Simple Justice, Suffrage in South Dakota. This is an original documentary for SDPB. It airs tonight on SDPB television at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. Brian, we'll bring you back into the fold. Let's talk about this film and how it all got put together, and how long did it take you to put this together?
Well, let's see. You know, we started on this, I would say, probably in the spring, mm-hmm. and really got rolling on it this summer. And of course, as you know, and I think people that listen regularly know, we've had guests on In the Moment talking about various suffrage-related topics. And what we're really about with this is just examining how this happened in South Dakota in particular, and looking at, you know, why did this take so long? What were the attitudes of people back then? What were some of the things that were, what were the arguments being made both for and against women's suffrage? They're myriad. There are plenty of them. A lot of different points of view. I really was quite surprised to learn during the process of making this that some scholars have identified this as not being about equality at all, that really it was a political move to bring white women into the ranks of voters, and that the best intended of the suffragists really thought, okay, we'll get this and we'll work on the rest of it later. Now, what's interesting about it is that if you go back to the very, very start of this, when Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage are really setting up the national organizations that would forward the suffrage movement for years and years, Stanton and Anthony had the view, you know, let's just get suffrage for white women and not worry about it. And that might be a little glib, but that's the summary. But Matilda Gage said, no, we need equal suffrage for everybody. We need equality across the board, regardless of race or religion. And so there were these divisions that were within the movement at the very beginning. And as you go through time, you see some of these divisions amplified over issues like prohibition and the status of immigrants. And immigrant voting in South Dakota was especially contentious because it had been written into the state constitution that non-citizen aliens could vote if they just simply declared their intention to become naturalized citizens. So, you know, if you're in South Dakota in the 1880s and, you know, you're this native-born woman and you might own your own land and you're being taxed on that, but you have no say in setting that up. But, you know, the guy who doesn't speak English down the road, he can vote. So there was this dynamic that pitted women against immigrants and against people of color, and it's in some ways it's not a surprise that it took so long.
SDPB's Brian Gevick, Simple Justice, Suffrage in South Dakota, airs tonight, 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB Television. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Chris.